So a few words about his background. He got his PhD from Marie Curie University. From there, he went to Lick in Amsterdam as a postdoc, and then joined MIT first as a postdoc, and now as a research scientist. And he's been instrumental in the team of people that actually made his prediction possible, and he's telling us about that and a few other things in that context.
Okay,
can I
turn the microphone on?
Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah. Otherwise, I can just be louder. I don't have a problem with that. Okay, thanks, Louis, and thank you all for being here and
for inviting me. It's my first time here, and I think I could have hardly picked a better moment to come and talk about gravitational waves. And don't believe the title, I'm not an astronomer. Okay. Okay, so this is the abstract of the paper that we published last week, if I'm right. And by now, I assume most of you at least heard that we found the gravitational waves emitted by a binary black hole. So two black holes merging together to form a new black hole. And there are several reasons why this is important. Some of them are listed at the bottom of this slide. But the most obvious is that this is the first detection, at least direct detection of gravitational waves. It's the first time we saw two black holes merging together. And these are pretty heavy stellar mass black hole, which also will teach us something. And finally, it allows for some quite good test of general relativity. And I will touch upon most of these points during my talk. And obviously, I should also stress, I'm a person, 1,000 person made the LVC. And I don't know everything. So when you have questions, there may be questions I'm not able to answer. I apologize in advance.
I think the first test of general relativity is the strong field dynamical relativity is cosmology.
So. We can talk about this at the end of the talk.
Well, it's a test.
So you probably want to put first direct detection, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's not written there. Okay, yeah. It's written here somewhere in the abstract. Okay. By the way, obviously, feel free to chime in during the talk. That's it. Okay, well, the outline is pretty basic. I'm going to basically tell you, spend most of my time talking about the event we found and starting with some introduction, in particular about our sources. We typically like to divide them in two big groups, vertical in the slides. We have transient sources, which last on our interferometers for from milliseconds to hours, depending on a few factors. And the two cases that we typically deal with are CBC, which stands for compact binary coalescences. So this is any pairwise combination of black hole and neutron star getting together. And also we have bursts. This is any violent event in the universe with a quadrupole moment that produces gravitational waves. The probably most famous example is core collapse supernovae. On the other side, we have persistent sources. They stay on our band for a very, very long time. And the two most famous cases are neutron stars with a small bump, so spinning neutron star with a mountain of a few millimeters. These produce monochromatic gravitational waves. And finally, we have the stochastic background. And this includes two contributions, the real cosmological background, and on the top of that, there may also be the sum of all the events which, taken one by one, are too weak to be detected, but all together can contribute to our, in our band. And today, we'll mostly focus on transients, starting with the compact binary coalescences, like the one we detected. And now, we typically like to divide them in three stages, depending on where they are on their life. When we talk of in spiral, when the two objects are very far away one from the other, and we can describe very well the waveform that comes out from the in spiral phase using just post-Newtonian theory. Okay. Then as the two horizons, in the case of black holes, start getting together, we talk of merger. And the merger was kind of a mystery until 10 years ago, roughly, when important progresses in numerical relativity gave us the first solution, and now we know how to handle that. And finally, you have a single black hole that has been formed. Obviously, it's out of equilibrium, so it rings down the excess of energy through gravitational waves. until it's gone. And this is the whole waveform. This, by the way, is not the event we detected. It's different masses and different parameters. But just to give you an idea, the amplitude increases with time until you have the merger, and then the ring down goes down. This is very beautiful. The situation is slightly more complicated for bursts, because bursts are just any astrophysical or cosmological phenomenon. And you see a few examples there. They all have in common that we either have a very poor idea of the waveform that will come out from the system, or simply don't know. They may be systems that we have not yet thought about. So burst searches also look for something which is totally unexpected or unknown. And this is also why probably the search and how to handle burst signals is somehow less advertised than CBC, but it's not because it's harder, but it's not because of that it's less interesting. And you know, we would not be doing this if it was easy, I guess. And here you see a few, to give you an idea, two possible signals coming out from a supernovae, a core collapse supernovae explosion. In this case, the mechanism is driven by a neutrino. In this case, the energies come from the orbital angular momentum. And you can see that they are totally different. So you really have to be open wide when you look for bursts. So this is from the detection side. How do we detect them? Sorry, from the source side. The detection side on Earth, it's based on interferometry. And by now, I assume most of you know that. Basically, we have these big interferometers. They are, the scale is 4 kilometers for the two LIGO instrument in the US. Virgo is slightly smaller, is in Italy, and it did not take part to the science run that just finished. It's still being upgraded. And then there is a small instrument called GEO that we use mostly for hardware testing and new technology. So the idea is that you have lasers circulating in two arms. If a gravitational wave passes through, the length of this arm will change, for example, being stretched, while the length of this arm will change in the other way, will be squeezed. And the resulting light that gets recombined at the photodetector here will change, will go phase in a way that we can see and measure. That is the basic idea, since gravitational wave deforms the space-time in squeezing and stretching in the other direction. And then you see pictorial representation of the two LIGOs here and Virgo there. OK. Now, let me spend a few minutes talking about searches and the searches that we just ran in the first science run. I'll start with the CBC. We had two online searches that went on during the first science run, plus one that happened offline in higher latency. And they overall covered a pretty large range of masses. We were looking in between 2 and 100 total solar masses. There is not a good reason for stopping at 100. It's just you have to pick a number. And they also, the waveform, were given the possibility of having spins between nearly maximally aligned along plus L or minus L. Now, the way this works, the searches works for CBC, it's pretty straightforward. Since we know what the waveform looks like in the case of CBC, you can just use match filter, which is a way to optimally extract information from the data when you know what you're looking for. And this is shown in this cartoon. You have a waveform embedded in your data, a CBC. This is your filter. It's not identical, I'm sorry. It basically goes through the data, and when it arrives at the right spot, your signal-to-noise ratio times series has a peak here, and it will loop over. And that's how you can say, oh, there is something there that is a CBC. This is nice. There is a small catch, though, is that the exact shape of this waveform and this phase evolution depends on the masses of the black hole and the spins. And we don't know those. So what do? You just try all the possible waveforms that you need to cover this parameter space. Okay. And in our case, they turn out to be roughly 10 to the 5 waveforms that you need to try to cover that mass and spin range and still be sure that if there is a signal with those parameters somewhere in those range, you will get it with a maximum loss of signal to noise ratio of 3%. Just to be clear, it doesn't really happen this way. This is too slow. We do everything in the frequency domain, but okay. Otherwise, it would be crazy. I mean, it takes longer for me to generate this video than to actually search in real time that. Okay, for bar searches, absolutely.
So all that data is saved, though, like in the hard drive?
We store everything, yeah.
Everything is stored,
yeah.
So you can go back and keep searching.
Absolutely. This is relevant. For example, it didn't happen in O1, as far as I know, but in the past, it happened that, for example, someone with like Swift saw a gamma ray burst and then told us, can you go back that day and look if there was anything? So we can always do that. Okay, for bar searches, we had two real-time searches going on. You know, one, they were covering a pretty broad range of frequencies between a few hertz and 2 kilohertz. And something which is quite new, it was not happening in initial LIGO, is that we had a kind of parameter estimation follow-up for bar searches, and actually very involved with that, since I kind of started it, where we also estimated sky position, for example, of the sources, even though they were unmodeled. And I will say something about this later. And something which I don't know much has been advertised is that both these searches found our event in low latency. So this black hole was found by the BARS unmodeled searches first, and then the compact, the CBC followed up in an optimal way. And I will come back to this point later. Now, BARS searches are, as you imagine by now, a bit more challenging because we have no idea what we're looking for. So we cannot just take a filter through the data and look for a maximum because we don't know what the filter would be. The way we do instead is that we look for excess of power in each of the instruments that take part to the analysis, also requiring that, first of all, it has to be consistent in time. If it's a real gravitational waves, it has to arrive in the two interferometer within a few milliseconds. Okay, it cannot arrive half an hour later. The time of flight of light between Amford and Leveson is 10 milliseconds, okay, so it has to be smaller than this. We can also require some consistency for in terms of morphology, like same frequency or similar frequency, okay. So that's the way you search for bursts. You analyze Leveson, and for if there is something simultaneous or roughly simultaneous, you record that time, and you get a detection statistic for it, like a signal-to-noise ratio, okay. And now I have a slide which I will not go through, but I should mention because I'm proud of it. This is one of the two codes that found the event on low latency and it has been invented by me. So it has to be here. Okay. And if you are curious, we can go back. But since it's lunchtime and people are digesting, it would probably put everyone asleep. Okay. Now you have a trigger, you have a candidate. How do you understand how significant it is, if it's real or not? To do that, you have to understand how often your instrument, just by themselves, left alone, would produce something which looked like that, okay? So the way you do that, if that was particle physics, you would turn your source off, and you just study the noise. We cannot turn gravitational waves off. So the way we do instead is slightly more complicated. When you look for event, you have the data in Amford and in Leveson, and the yellow things, these are just excess of power in the instrument. And sometimes they happen to be coincident. In this case, the star is a real event, which is obviously a coincidence. Okay, so you run the search, you get these four candidates, and each of them is given a signal-to-noise ratio. Okay, now to understand what the noise, if the noise could produce something like this, the way you do is that you take the data in one of the interferometer and you move it a bit ahead on time. This way, you are by more than 10 milliseconds. This way, you are sure that whatever coincidences are formed cannot be astrophysical. They are not due to gravitational waves because you are not, you know, confronting the same times. An interesting possibility is that if there is something real, it may coincide with noise on the other instrument. And this has some interesting consequences that if people have time later, we can discuss. Anyway, then you run your search on this fake data stream where, you know, there is an extra time delay. And you get signal-to-noise ratio for these triggers. So these basically give you the distribution of a signal-to-noise ratio in absence of real coincidence gravitational wave, which we call a background. We do this several times, tie sliding every time, until we collect the equivalent of several thousand years of background coming only from noise, OK? And then what you do is that you compare the signal-to-noise ratios of these guys with the signal-to-noise ratio of these guys, which only come from noise. And this is probably going to be clear in a second with this slide. Okay. In this slide, which are the actual results for that we just published for this bar search, in the x-axis, you have your detection statistics. It can be SNR. In this case, it's a log likelihood. What is important is that here on the right, you have stuff that look like a gravitational wave. Okay. And the vertical dashed line gives you the SNR signal or log likelihood of the event. Okay, it's 0.7 or 8. In the y-axis, you have the false alarm in 1 over year. So in here, the farther down you go, the more rare are things. And the blue distribution is the background. So this is only noise. Okay. These are the distribution. This is the distribution of SNR or loudness or whatever for noise trigger. So if you want to know how often your noise would produce something which is as loud as your candidate or louder, you just check where these two curves intersect, which is here. You go all the way to the y-axis, and you see that it's a few 10 to the minus 4. And this means that you expect the noise to produce something as significant as GW5914 only once every 27,000 years, which is this number there. If you convert that, it's 4.6 sigma. So it's not 5 sigma yet. Please.
The seismic events.
We so yes, seismic happens mostly at low frequencies. This analysis starts at 16 Hertz. Okay, so we don't go that far down.
And,
yeah. And obviously we also have seismometers. So when there are known moments in which the seismic is really bad, it doesn't make it to the analysis. We can get rid of those times. Okay. Yeah, because by doing this, basically, we don't do this time sliding once. We do this time sliding a lot of time. And every time, actually, I should also say that this end goes back to the beginning. So effectively, you always have the same chunk of time, of, you know, effective time. So every time you do this, you basically have, if that's a day, one day worth of coincidence data. And as you do the next time slide, it's another day. And doing this over and over by steps of roughly 100 milliseconds, you can simulate thousands of years of data. And since that's a Poissonian
I'm uncorrelated, so it's the same data, you're just shifting things around. So, I think there's some inherent assumption that the noise is uncorrelated from time to time.
Yeah, it's a Poissonian. We assume it's Poissonian. So, and it is the case. I don't have a plot with me, but if it were Poissonian, you would expect that every time you do this, there is roughly the same number of, and one of our papers, there is this plot, and it shows that the true minus expected is basically picked at zero. It works well. It's indeed, there is this built-in assumption. As I said, we had two searches. I have the plot for bars. The other one is much, there is more stuff. It would take me 5 minutes. So I will skip it. We can come back to this at question time if people want. OK, so as I said, these two codes found the event with a few minutes latency. It was 3 minutes in one case and 10 minutes on the other or so. Then we started building a time frequency decomposition of the data around the event. This is for Enford and this is for Leveson. And what we saw is that the frequency increased with time in a few, tens of milliseconds. And from, our experience, we know that this is what we would expect for a signal emitted by a binary coalescence. Because as I showed you before, the amplitude and the phase, increase. Okay? The amplitude increase with time, sorry, in the frequency. So people started realizing, oh, this is probably, it's not just anything. It's a CBC. And the beautiful thing about this event is that, as you probably saw, we can actually see it in the data. So people at MIT were having fun of me because I do that analysis. And you don't really need that analysis here. It's like you take data, you band pass it, it's there. Okay, I got my salary for nothing last few months. And if you're not convinced, you get the data. This is Enford, Livingstone. You put them together, it's amazing. So I'm actually trying to follow in roughly the chronological order in which things happen. After a while, CBC kicked in. Once it was clear that it was a CBC or there was a strong suspect, obviously the CBC search, it's more optimal than the bars because they can dig further down in the noise since they have a model. So this plot is roughly the same, the meaning is the same. I told you we have two searches in Lole. I'm just showing the results for one of them. They are very compatible. So again, here you have your SNR, or detection statistics, and this is the false alarm or something proportional to it. The event is here, okay, is this square here. I told you that to understand how significant it is, you have to see where it intersects the noise from the background. In this case, it turns out, and I can tell why there are two curves, that it does not intersect. It's just so loud that there is nothing when you do the time slide that matches that, or even in the foreground. This means that you cannot calculate the false alarm. We can only put a bound. And this is better than once every 200,000 years, which is larger than 5.1 sigmas. Okay. Now, the reason why there are two curves here, it's, if you remember, I told you that when you do the time slide, it can happen that a real gravitational wave coincides with noise. And in that case, you get something which is significant, because in, at least in one interferometer, there is a gravitational wave. And this is what this black background is. The reason you have these peaks, this is the candidate in one interferometer coinciding while doing the time slide with something else in the other interferometer. So if when you start your analysis, suppose you are skeptical, you don't believe that these are real gravitational waves, so you think, I want to leave it in the data even if it coincides with everything else. And if you do that, it's still, you know, not as significant as the real event. If you get rid of the event before doing the time slides, then you get this blue curve, which is even sharper down. So it's even more significant. Anyways, the ones with the best eyes will now notice that there is here, you know, kind of hint of something above the background floor. And we calculate the false alarm of that. It's once every 2 years. This is not enough per se to claim a detection. It's roughly 2 sigma. But I'm one of the person who actually looked at, you know, the parameters of this. And if you believe that's astrophysical, it's a binary black hole too. It's lighter than this one. The masses are 10 and 15 solar masses or something similar. So we cannot claim that's a detection alone. But you know, it seems to point to a population of black holes somehow. Please.
So that other one, I mean, it's not a false alarm rate, but can you overlap the templates and everything matches up the way the 159.14 or did they bother to try?
I did. No, obviously. I mean, I've done that. I believe it's an event. It matches. Obviously, the posterior distribution for the parameters are wider because it's quieter. This is a scenario. I didn't say that. Oh, you see it. Is it signal-to-noise ratio 24? That's loud. This is 10. Okay, so obviously, everything is fuzzier in the noise. But let me put it this way. In the paper, it's written that we cannot pinpoint that excess to anything known in the instrument, which is a way to say that, you know, we believe it's a gravitational wave. Okay, okay. Please.
Well, you know that you
How well do we know, sorry, what?
How well do you know the detection rate per year?
That's written here. So that's my next point. That's my next point. So. The question was, you know, what can we say about the rate of black holes emerging either in our detector or in the universe? Okay, how many we see. And now, so what we have done is that we have used the fact that we have detected this and possibly this guy here to constrain the rate in which black hole binaries are formed and actually coalesce in the universe or in the local universe. And the number that comes out if you do that, the way you do it, okay, I'm not an expert, but it's pretty straightforward. You know how long you observed, a few months. You know which volume of the universe you were sensitive to, you know, and you can see how many were formed. And you get a number, a range which is pretty large. It goes in between 2 mergers and 400 per gigaparsec cube per year. This is still very large, but the important point in this number is that zero is not there anymore. Because there were, no, I'm actually serious, because there are theories that just said that black holes cannot merge within an Hubble time, okay? So this proves that those theories are wrong. And by the way, for most of what I said, we have papers which are linked in my presentation where we, you know, expand on some of these particular topics more deep than I can do now.
Question. So that range, is it like 95% range or what
is that? This is a 90% credible interval, I think. Okay. I mean, the 2 is probably safer than, because we know it's not
okay,
zero for sure. Please.
So my understanding is that this comes from 16 days.
Yeah.
And now you have 4 months.
Yeah.
Would you be breaking any laws if you told us if this was atypical or typical?
I would break a lot of laws. So.
Can you tell us all and then kill us afterwards?
he's being recorded.
You don't know.
The magic number 7 events that people have thrown is because of those? Just...
I don't know. Yeah, someone one day showed up at MIT. Oh, I heard you guys at 7 events. Yeah. No, I don't know. With the 7, I've never got to understand.
Okay,
in here, you know, if you have a lot of fantasy, you can see maybe this 2. Okay. I don't know. I think.
Is this 2 within 16 days or 2 within.
This is only the 16 days that we publish. So between September the 14th and October the 20th, I think. 16 obviously is coincidence, okay, which is not calendar. Okay, so these 2 codes found the event in low latency. They didn't just find it, they also produced sky maps, okay, which were sent to astronomers, but not all of them, astronomers which had the MOUs with LIGO for follow up. And each code produced a different sky map. This is, well, there are no names, it's okay. You see the sky map here and there. They are not identical. They pick the same ring on the sky. They're not identical, which is not surprising because they are a model code. So they make slightly different assumptions on what, where to look and how. But you know, roughly speaking, it's the same ring on the sky. Later on, CBC kicked in and we, and actually I, run the code to produce parameter estimation and sky maps, assuming that it was a compact binary coalescence. And this is the sky map that you get. It's very similar, especially to this one. So everything is nice, everything looks nice. I cannot tell you what the results are of this because astronomers will be publishing. Actually, they already started their own papers and they couldn't keep up with the archive. It's just crazy. Okay. Let me now switch a bit topic, and this is what I do mostly for a living. So it's nice, we detect this. What can we learn about black holes? You know,
can I just ask you,
absolutely.
How long was the engineering run, or how many engineering runs?
Before
total time that the system was on before the event.
Oh, okay, I see. So the engineering now run, the last engineering run before one was ER8. Okay, ER8 was the 8th. They were not in a row though.
No, I mean the advanced Voyager.
Yeah.
How long was it in operation before the big event was seen?
That's another question. It was roughly 2 weeks, at least.
Is that total time?
That's calendar time. That's calendar time. Okay, so sometimes interferometer are off because this was. We transitioned from commissioning to engineering run to science run, okay?
Right.
So in between commissioning and engineering run, there were still something that needs occasional fixing. But the last few days have been, before we actually, one was supposed to start, where basically everything was in place. The last pieces was calibration, and that was done the week before this was detected. And that's also why the 2 codes were already up and running. Okay.
So you say roughly 2 weeks.
Yeah, at least, yeah. Don't quote me on that because a lot happened from now, between now and then. But it was let me put it this way: the interferometers were this is one of the first things we checked. Were stable. They were, they were okay. Oh, okay. My program just crashed. I'm sorry. You have to. New computer is on the way. So you can enjoy DALI in the meantime. Okay, let me see if that's better. Yeah. Is it there? Yeah. Okay, so sources and what we can learn out of those. Okay, so the important thing here is that, and why I spend most of my time working with CBCs is that, measuring, besides the detection, which is very exciting, but understanding something about the mass and the spin of black hole and measuring them can tell us something about the way these mergers came together and even about the actual objects themselves. For example, when you take a compact binary coalescence, and that's what we're discussing earlier with Lewis, people typically have 2 main scenarios in mind as for how these 2 guys got together. In one case, which is called common envelope evolution, you just assume that that was a binary system to start with when they were normal stars. Then they went supernovae, evolved into black hole, neutron star, and merged. And people typically think that happens in galactic fields. And the numerical simulation says that in this case, you would expect the final masses to be not too different, okay? Extreme mass ratios are excluded. And also, people typically think that spins, or black holes in particular, in those cases are aligned by the time they are on our LIGO band because of the common envelope phase. On the other side, you may have something called dynamical capture, which is what the name said. And this is thought to happen in globular cluster or anyway in dense environment in which you have a big black hole that sinks into the center of the potential, gets something else on its way through, and you have a binary system. In that case, a priori, you don't expect any constraint on the mass ratio. It really depends what happened. And the spins can be oriented in whatever way they want. So you can kind of see what I'm aiming at here is that if I know something about the masses or mass ratios and the spin, since they are so different in these two scenarios, I may be able to now try to understand how the system was formed in the first place. The other thing is that when you just focus about one particular black hole is that if you are able to tell how big black hole, how massive black hole can get, this tells you something about the progenitor star. In particular, I will have a slide about this on the metallicity of the progenitor star. Now, you know that obviously we already know something about black holes and masses and spins. And the way we know is through X-ray binaries. And we can measure both masses and spins. But the truth is that for both measurement, I mean, you know, they are indirect measurement. For example, for the masses, to estimate the mass of black holes in binaries, in X-ray binaries, you have to measure a few parameters, like the period of the orbit, the velocity, the inclination. And sometimes it's good and you get small errors. Sometimes it can be pretty bad and you have huge errors. Or even systems like these two that people do not believe. They think there is something wrong with the radial velocity measurement. So if you exclude those two and take systems that you believe, typically we are somewhere in between 5 and 15 solar masses, roughly. Okay. For spin, the situation is even more complicated, probably, because we have two different methods to measure spins in X-ray binaries. And they both rely, they're called iron line and continuous fitting. They rely on a modeling of the disk around the black hole. Okay, and the bad thing is that even though very often they agree, there are systems for which they are known to disagree at several sigma level, which may point out to a potential, you know, systematics which are not totally under control.
Picton solar mass was seen in the dwarf galaxy in 2007.
Okay.
Has it been corroborated?
I'm not sure. I think so. If it is this guy here, I assume. No, wait, this is extragalactic. Yes, it must be here, right? I think so. Excuse me?
It's not as well corroborated as the others.
Oh, well, there are two people. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure. I'm not an astronomer. I was under the impression that these two guys here were accepted by the astrophysical community, while these two, which are more massive, were still. Right. That doesn't matter because we found something heavier. So we superseded that. So what was my point in that? With gravitational wave, we can measure directly the mass and spin of black holes. And before I talk about the actual mass and spin of the black hole binary we detected, I'll spend a few minutes telling you a bit about how we measured this and what we can expect in general. And hopefully you will appreciate better what we found, what we measured, and why especially, okay? So let me start by saying something which it's pretty, is well known for us, but not for people outside our community, is that obviously black hole have spin, as I just told you, between 0 and 1. Every value in the range has been basically found. And if the spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum, as expected in some scenarios, astrophysical scenarios, then we know that in gravitational wave that analysis, there is a pretty important degeneracy between the mass, in particular the mass ratio of the two objects, and the spin. And this is shown probably best in this plot, comes from this paper. In this plot, you have on the x-axis the total mass of a black hole binary. This is 20, okay? And on the y-axis, you have the mass ratio in this strange units. Basically, this is equal mass, and the lower you go, the more unequal are the masses. What these plots want to show is that if you start from a binary black hole, which has 20 solar masses and 0.16 mass ratio and no spin, you can get the same identical match to the data if you move anywhere along this curve, changing the spin. So you can get something which is lighter with a different mass ratio and a spin of 0.3, and you still have the same waveform. So this tells you that there is degeneracy which tells you that the estimation of both spin and masses in this case will be pretty, large. Okay, and with a in a paper led by my student at MIT, we saw that in these cases we can expect errors on the mass ratio of roughly 25-30%. This is much larger than what we get for a neutron star. Neutron star, please, in whatever order.
Is that a real degeneracy or a strong correlation?
It's a correlation. They enter in the post-Newtonian waveform in some combination that is hard to disentangle if they're aligned. If they're not aligned, it's different.
So what range of spin is this true of? I would imagine the spins got very large and see precession and all of that.
I'll go back to precession in a second. But about the range, though, what can help you is that if the real system is already here, and the correlation are such that to mimic that, you would have to go to the unphysical region of the mass ratio, then obviously there is an hard bound, and you know there is a limit to where this curve can go in that direction. Anyway, we'll have more about this in a second.
You're saying unphysical, is that just because you presumed that M1 is smaller than
M2? No, this is basically, it's like, okay, in terms of mass ratio, it's between 0 and 1. You cannot go larger than 1, okay? It's not unphysical. I didn't make this paper. It's equal mass, okay? It cannot be more equal than equal mass.
What is the observable from where you derive this mass in spin?
In the waveform? You mean is what determines how well you can measure this is the phase evolution of the waveform, okay?
And from there, then you...
We measure masses and spins.
And then
yeah.
They are.
This will probably be, we can come back to this point if it's not clear. And actually, I have a plot about something similar, is that to show this with an actual waveform, these are two waveforms with the same total mass of 15, starting at the same frequency, 30 hertz, that's arbitrary somewhere in our band. And that the point here is that if you start with 0.9 spin, so nearly maximal, a mass ratio of 2 to 1, you get this waveform. If you take the same total mass, same everything else, but you change the mass and spin so that the spin is 0, so it's gone, and the mass ratio now is 0.4, you get a waveform which is not identical because I just eyeballed, I cheated, but they can be identical, okay? So this indeed is the point that you can always tweak with both parameters and get something which looks very similar. However, as your colleague just pointed out, the situation is slightly better, actually much better sometimes, if, as is true in the most generic case, you have precession. So what we would expect in the most general case is that both black holes have a spin vector which is not aligned, is misaligned, then you have a net orbital, a total angular momentum, and the orbit precesses around J, and so do the spin. So
Not the
link. Yeah, fair enough. All of this is relevant. Okay, good point. We had a very interesting morning, and as I was telling, this kind of discovery got us a bit unprepared because we're looking for lower mass black hole, not for 30 solar masses, because of the X-rays measurement. So most of what I said, it's has been shown true. Okay, I don't know if it's false, but it's been shown for sure to be true for lower masses. You know, this is typical 15 total, in which the merger and ring down do not play an important role because they are at higher frequency and LIGO is not so sensitive at higher frequency. What your colleague is telling that as the mass gets larger and larger, the merger and ring down go to lower frequency, so LIGO can see it, as it was the case for the event we detected. And the merger and ring down also contain information about the component masses in a way which is slightly complementary to the in spiral. So putting both information together, we can do something better. And this is yet to be, though, mathematically, like numerically quantified.
What would be the optimal mass of the final black hole so that...
The one we detected. The one... I'm not joking. It's the one we detected. I was at a conference in Japan in July or June, and there was, I don't know if you know, Bruce Allen is the person who invented Einstein atom. And it was... saying, you know, if we did something of 30 solar masses, we'll have the same SNR in the merger and down in the spiral. And 2 months later, that's why he's a professor. Yes?
You have a citation to a website. In the website, there are 225 templates for different parameters for mass ratios and spins.
Okay.
And you chose the 225th in your paper. The question is why?
I'm not familiar with this web page. We can go through it later. I don't have no idea what you're talking about, but there must be a reason. We can take some time after this.
The strain.
256.
Is supposed to determine these parameters. S1, S2.
Okay, I will say something about this later, but I may as well clarify something. The parameters we estimate do not come from the search stage. So when we filter the data to look for a CBC, search a CBC, as I told you, we try roughly 10 to the 5 templates. So this is a grid. It's not geometrical. It's not a real grid, but to give you an idea, which means that there are holes in the middle. We don't care about these holes because when we want to find the signal, the only thing that matters is that the SNR, it's above detectability, OK? What happened next when we care about estimating the parameters is that we run a stochastic sampling, MCNC. I will say something about this later. And that's a continuous process, so it can go in between points, OK? So the masses and spins found by the search are not the one we believe. They are the one of the template that was closest to, you know, if you are far away from here and the real signal is here or here, is the one that was closest to it in some SNR parameter space, okay? And all of these are different, M1, M2, spin 1, and spin 2, okay? So this is only the one that happened to be closest. But then we run Monte Carlo codes, which can go anywhere in between and get the real, you know, posterior distribution. I will come back, it's Bayesian, but yeah, I'll come back to this point later. Okay, so where were I? Yeah, spins. So having precession, it's good for a reason and bad for another reason. It's good because it gives much more physics to the problem, and that helps reducing degeneracies. In particular, the spin-orbit coupling, which is the lowest order effect, makes the orbit precess around the orbital, the total angular momentum, and that gives amplitude modulation to the waveform. We also get phase modulation from higher order. The bad news is that this introduces more dimensions to the problem, so everything gets a bit slower and more complicated. The waveforms are beautiful, though. This is a beautiful waveform with precession. Again, this is just the inspirer, as we were saying before. Oh, and there was the audio, which I missed. Going back? Okay. I don't know if it's back. No, probably not. You see, it's modulating. It's not the usual chirp you hear that is continuous. This was with amplitude. It's pretty nice. I can give you the okay. So this is nice. However, something that is not often realized is that the amount of modulation in the system frame is that one. In the detector frame, it might be smaller. Okay, and the reason is that depending on how the system is oriented, the effect of the orbit doing this may be more or less visible. And that's pretty easy to realize. If the system is what we call face-on, which means that you look at the orbit this way with the two objects doing this, even if the plane is doing this, you don't see very much. You don't see modulation. The best case is if you're looking at the system from edge-on, that way any small variation, it's amplified. And since I like videos, you can see this in a video. These are the plus and cross polarization of the same waveform. The only things that change is that I'm taking the system and doing this. I'm observing at it through different angles, then it loops. I'm sorry you cannot read the label probably, but you can believe me that this is edge-on. You see the maximum amount of precession, and now it's going to face-on, and you don't see anything, basically, OK? So this, again, is to make the point that depending on how the system is oriented, even though the spins might have been processing, you may not see it, OK? And that will have a role for our event. This is nice, the video. We can also put numbers. Just forget about the labels. These are just a bunch of black holes and neutrons, and black hole, and neutron star black hole. On the y-axis here, you have the uncertainty in the estimation is 1 sigma percent. This is 10, 20. In the estimation of the spin magnitude of the most massive of the two objects, okay? These are typically 10, 5, or 10 something. And this is the inclination angle. So this is the angle between the orbital angular momentum and the line of sight. So 0 is face on, pi over 2 is edge on. And as you can see, indeed, it is the case that the errors for all the systems reach their minimum when you're looking at the system this way, because the effect of precession are totally visible at Earth. And furthermore, you can see that the ratio of uncertainties between the best and worst case scenario is a factor of several, which at least to me suggests that detecting one system in this region will tell us much more than detecting a bunch of systems which are face on. Unfortunately, the catch is that systems with this inclination are much harder to detect than systems with this inclination. And the reason is because if you have a CBC, most of the power goes along L. Okay? So it's statistical. That implies that statistically it's much easier to detect something like this because you can see them farther away and there is more volume out there. Okay.
So where's beta? What's Q and beta?
Yeah, that's why I told you to ignore the because I don't have time. Q is the mass ratio. So I was trying black holes with different mass ratio. Q1 is equal mass, and 2 and 3. And these are neutron star black hole. Beta is the angle or the cosine of the angle between L and the spin. So how misaligned they are, basically, OK?
The spin of black hole.
Yeah, yeah. For a neutron star black hole, the black hole is dominating. So it's only one. Anyway, the point, yeah, I wanted to check how much this depends on my actual choice of parameters. And it doesn't mean the ratio between max and min changes, but the global behavior is the same. We can go a bit, you know, these are just a bunch of systems. So let's go to something which is more extensive and consider a population of signals of black hole binaries and neutron star black hole. A caveat that from discussion with this morning, I should underline, these are all systems smaller than what we detected. This will play a role later. So in this plot, on the x-axis, I have the uncertainty on the estimation of the spin magnitude. So this is 1%, 10%. I don't want to mention this. This in the y-axis, you have the error or the uncertainty in the estimation of the tilt angle. This is the angle between the spin and the orbital angular momentum. It's interesting if you want to check whether the spins are aligned or not. OK, but let's focus on the x-axis. And the color bar, is the magnitude of the spin that I put in the data. So 1, red, means the black hole was maximally spinning. 0 means there was no spin. So we see a few things here. First of all, like in the X-ray binaries, it is the case that the smaller the spin, the largest the uncertainty. It's very hard to measure small spins, okay? And you can see that the bulk of the distribution here is close to several tenths of percent of uncertainty. The other thing you can see is that neutron star, which are diamonds in this plot, as opposed to circles, which are black hole, so the black hole neutron star can reach, you know, the bottom left corner, which is smaller errors. And the reason why it is so is that black hole neutron star have larger mass ratios, since the neutron star is pretty small. And the effect of spin, if you look just at the post-Newtonian evolution, it's literally multiplied by the mass ratio, okay, or by the inverse. So it's the effect of spins are enhanced if the mass ratio is larger. Okay, that's why for black hole neutron star, you can get error uncertainties of even just a few percent, while for black hole, they are typically larger. And you also see, as I said, a correlation with the spin magnitude. You do better for large spins.
So in this plot, all of the SNR, or?
No, this is an astrophysical, okay, this may not be evident. By astrophysical population, I mean that they were, the sky was populated in a way which is uniform in volume. So you have more events far away than nearby because there is more volume. That's what you would expect. The probability is proportional to D squared. So it's uniform in volume and randomly oriented, randomly in the sky, and whatever. Everything is random.
Pierre Baker talked about 62 solar.
Yeah.
What happens if you use that instead of less than 50
solar? I'll cover that in a second. And actually, yeah, since we're talking about masses, this is a similar plot for the same event, but here I'm showing different quantities. On the x-axis, I have the uncertainty on the chair mass. This is a weird combination of mass one and mass two that we use because it enters the lowest position in order. The only thing that is important here is that it's better than 1%. This is 0.1%. And here, which is more important, is the uncertainty in the estimation of the component mass, in this case, mass one. This is 1%, 10%, okay? So what you can see is that, first of all, they don't not now strongly dependent on the true spin. But more important is that the bulk here for the component mass uncertainties is well above 10, between 10 and 20%. You will see when I talk about the event is that we can do better, okay? And the reason why we do better for the event is indeed related to the mass and what we were saying before. Since the mass for the event, sorry, I've been calling the event for 3 months. I'm not going to change now. Is higher mass. So we see the merger and the ring down. And as I told you, that helps. That gives extra information that I don't have here because I'm stopping at 15 solar masses. That's what we can do better for the event. OK, and I'm about to talk about this. Just a technical slide. I'm sorry, I need to do that. With the only question I have is that all the results I showed and the results we produced for the papers we published come from, as I said, a stochastic sampling of the parameter space. There is a paper you can check out or ask me, since I'm one of the developer of that. And what you want to do, basically, at the end of the day, is calculate a posterior distribution for theta, where theta is spin 1, spin 2, mass 1, mass 2, distance, orientation, sky position, everything, as a function of the data. If you use Bayes' theorem, that is prior times likelihood, OK? And the reason why we use Monte Carlos instead of just gridding is that theta, in the most generic case, is 15 dimension, okay? So we cannot just put points. That's why we need to use something trickier and slightly more expensive. So about the paper and the results themselves that we published, we have been pretty careful. We use two different waveform families because something that is always in the back of our mind is waveform systematics, okay? So we use in particular one waveform that has precessing spin, so it allows for the spin if they want to go anywhere, while the other assumes that the spins are aligned. What happened for this particular event is that the results came back to be basically the same, which already tells you that either there was no precession or was not visible. Otherwise, the results would be totally different.
So, when you say aligned, could they be anti-aligned?
Yeah, yeah. Modulo sign. Okay. Plus L or minus L, we don't differentiate.
Oh, but it could be...
Yeah, yeah. They can do whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's an effective spin at the end of the day, but that's a bit too technical maybe. But yeah, can be negative. And the other thing is that we use two independent sampling of the parameter space, one based on MCNC, Monte Carlo, the other based on something called nested sampling. One samples the prior, the other the posterior. The results came back to be identical, as you would have hoped. The other thing that we checked is that we took into account potential calibration error in interferometers, since they can be typical 10% level. So we marginalize over them. In the past, me and others have shown that they can hurt your parameter estimation. Finally, and this is like a kind of teaser for later, we assume that generativity is correct. Okay. Okay. Let me show you the results, and I'll go one plot at a time. In here, I'm showing the posterior distribution for the event. In the y-axis, you see the posterior for the distance, the luminosity distance to the event. It's peaks at 400 megaparsec roughly. Okay, that's the number you probably saw. I can come back later on question time at what all the curves are, why there are several. It's just a waveform, you can guess. On the x-axis, which is what I would like you to pay attention to, this is the inclination angle. And as you can see, it peaks very close to 170, 60, 70, so face away from you or face on. Okay, so it basically excludes this configuration. And after, I mean, the reason I spent 40 minutes talking about the thing before is because now you understand that this implies that we did a poor job estimating the spins. Okay, and indeed, it's what you see in this plot, which shows, well, first of all, bottom line from the paper, we can only constrain the spin very loosely. We can only basically say that we're not maximally spinning. Now, on this plot, you see on the y-axis, what we call the efficient chi, this is basically the projection of the spin along L. So it's the part of the spin that doesn't give precession. It's along L. And In this plot, instead, you see the component perpendicular to L. So that's the component that would give the precession, which cannot see in this particular case. And black is the posterior distribution. Green is the prior. That's a Bayesian code. We have priors. Okay, and you see something quite interesting. While when it comes to the component along L, the prior and the posterior are very different, which means that the data told us something we didn't know a priori. And it told us that the component along L must be pretty small, though quite uncertain. Instead, and interestingly, the component of the spin along L is such that the prior and the posterior are basically the same. So the data is not telling us anything or very little information about the component of spin, precessing component, which again comes from the geometry of the system. Finally, masses, since people love masses, M1, M2, the main point here is that they are very large. We are talking of 35 solar masses. This is in the source frame, and 30 solar masses. Now,
can I ask just a quick question?
Absolutely.
So is it clear for the orientations and such how you might pick the priors and random orientations and things like that, but what about masses and other parameters that
good point.
Assume things about the population that are very uncertain?
Yeah, yeah, I didn't say that because it's complicated. Well, not complicated. It takes time, but since you ask, we obviously have priors on everything, okay? And the prior on the masses are flat. The component masses, we don't assume any astrophysical model built in a priori, okay? And they are flat in a range which is much larger than this, between, I think, 2 and 100, roughly like the searches. So the fact that this is only 10 solar masses, it's highly similar. We didn't put the priori here because it would be a box, basically, covering the whole space, okay? So this is the only parameter for which the posterior and the prior come back to be the same. For everything else, the data is informative. Okay, thank you, it's a good point. Okay. Now, we learned something from the fact that the masses are very large and also from the size of the error. As we said, the fact that the masses are large means that the black hole merge in the LIGO band. Now, if you make some calculations of this, you will see that the component masses are estimated to 50% uncertainty. And you see that this is kind of in the lower side of what I showed you before, and it's because we have information from the merger and the ring down. On the other end, for the chair mass, which is this weird combination, while before I showed better than 1%, it is much larger. And the reason is that there is now less in spiral. I mean, there is a price to pay. You either get more measuring down or more in spiral. Okay, and this, interesting enough, this is something technical that we love, other people may not give anything about, is that these two measurements are somehow, you have to pick one and the other will pay the price. Now the fun part. If you assume that generativity is correct, then knowing the initial masses and spins automatically tells you what the final mass and spin of the black hole, remnant black hole, must be. That's built in GR, it's built in a waveform. Okay. If you do that, you get this mass, 62.4 solar masses, and this final spin, 0.68 or so. Okay. This is beautiful. If you are very quick with mathematics, you will have noticed that 3 solar masses are disappeared, subtracting this from the initial 2 masses. And they obviously are gone in gravitational wave energy. Okay, they have been burned metaphorically burned by the merger. And something which I found entertaining is calculating the area of these black holes. And what turns out is that the initial black hole, as you know, I mean, these things are very compact, was roughly 10 to the 5 kilometers square each, and they form a black hole of 4 × 10⁵ kilometers square. By comparison, Ontario is 1 million kilometers square. Okay, I found this very funny. Okay, now, as I said, we also will hope to learn something about the project. Please.
Just to clarify, so these, the measurement of the final black hole is just combining the measurements of the initial black hole?
It's built in the waveform. So, yeah. It's an information that comes from the waveform. The steps are initial mass and spin, numerical relativity, fitting gives you the final mass and spin, okay? But information comes through the whole waveform. I will come back to this point later because that's one of the things. We relax this assumption to test this, okay? You spoiled my talk. Okay, astrophysical implication, I think that's there are several. This is the one I find you know, more entertaining, is that we want to learn something about the progenitor of these two black holes. Now, in this plot I'm showing, this comes from one of our papers, the metallicity of the progenitor stars in a fraction of solar. This is one solar metallicity, 1/10. And in here, on the y-axis, you see the maximum mass of the black hole that that star can form, okay, this initial star. And what these curves tell you is they tell you, depending on which model you assume for the wind on the progenitor star, they can be very weak or very strong, how the metallicity and the final mass are related. And the thing which is important here is that if you assume that your initial stars are the strong winds, then no matter what metallicity you pick, you cannot form a black hole more massive than 25-ish solar masses. And since we observe 29 and 36 or 37, whatever, that means that we can strongly disfavor the strong wind model. If instead you work with weak winds, which apparently, I'm not an astronomer, but it's what people seem to prefer more and more now, indeed, that seems to work better for us too, because now, if that is your relationship between metallicity and final mass, you see that with the weak wind model for your progenitor, you can form black hole of 30 or 40 solar masses as long as your initial metallicity is below roughly 0.5 of the solar metallicity. So we learned something about the progenitors. And again, there is more in this paper. Okay, that's what we're all waiting for, test of GI. And I'm biased because I've been working on this for a while in LIGO. And to me, and we can discuss later, it seems, you know, it seems clear that this event and gravitational waves in general represent our first chance to look at GR in a strong field regime where dynamical interactions are important, so the static part of GR. And to give people an idea of the order of magnitude involved, I like to compare with the double binary pulsar that is the most relativistic system probably we know so far. And in that case, you have two objects of roughly solar mass, 1.4 something, that move around at a relative speed of 1/10⁻³, the speed of light, with a period that changes with a derivative, which is roughly 10⁻¹². By comparison, the event we detected were two objects of a few 10 solar masses moving around in the last few orbits at half the speed of light, relative, and with a amount of energy involved that it's crazy. You know, the maximum, the peak instantaneous luminosity was 10⁵⁶ Earth per second, which is more luminous than everything else in the universe combined. And that is what probably what I like the most. The derivative of the orbital period was of the order of unity, as opposed to 10⁻¹². Okay. So to me, this, and other people at least, you know, points out the fact that we are really accessing a different territory. Please.
How do you determine the luminosity?
Well, we have the strain.
You don't know where it is.
That as no. Well, we can assume, we can, we know the we know h of t, okay, and in general relativity, you can calculate the emitted luminosity of power as a function of h of t. It may be built in that it's well, actually no. We okay. As I said, we know how gravitational waves are emitted. We know it's not a 4π phenomenon. We know that most of the energy goes along L. And minus L, we know the antenna pattern, we know everything. I've not done the calculation, but I know it can be done, taking into account the geometry of the system.
You'll be able to measure the luminosity.
Excuse me?
Someday you'll be able to measure the luminosity.
But this is the inter-array luminosity. The whole energy that you release in that.
This is the peak, okay? Okay, the peak. Yeah.
But it's the over inter-array over the full surface.
Yeah. Oh, in this particular case, being the luminosity, yeah, by definition. Yeah. And we know also how many solar masses disappeared, which can convert in energy.
Squaring up the strain.
Yeah. Well, we use GR, basically. That's a fair point, actually. It's kind of circular, the argument. Yeah, I agree with you. Okay. So, this said, this is why, I mean, this striking difference between the double pulsar and what we can do. It's why, at least in LIGO, a few people got excited about the idea of doing tests of GR. We started in a coordinated way a few years ago, and I'm lucky enough to have been one of the founders of that group, and people at the beginning looked at us like we were crazy. And we didn't start from scratch. There is a quite rich amount of literature on test of GR with gravitational waves for pulsars, timing, space, and ground-based vector. But the thing is that most of the existing literature focused on the testing some specific alternative to GR, okay? While we realized, and there are a bunch of people we put together with collaborators and friends, that would be nice to have a test which is as, you know, generic as possible. So in other words, that does not require you to know what the actual theory of GR is, okay, which we may not know. So in the paper we published on the event, we tried for as much as possible to follow this approach and go for a model test. There is one test that checks a particular theory. We'll see in a second. Okay, to go back to my final mass and spin. So the fact that the final mass and spin depends uniquely on the initial mass and spin is true in GR. We know how to calculate that. In some theories, however, that's not required. You may have some strange mechanism that makes that not true. So what we have done is the following. Let's try to calculate the mass and the spin of the final black hole only using information from this spiral. So in this plot, I have the final mass and the final spin. Okay, this dashed line called in spiral here is the contour of the estimation of the final mass and spin if I only use the piece of waveform that is the in spiral. Okay, so I stop at 132 hertz in this case. Okay, as you can see, it's pretty broad. It's pretty large because the spiral doesn't give you a lot of information about the component masses, which in turn means that you have quite a lot of uncertainty in the final mass. This other curve here called post-spiral, which is this dash purple, and a priori using purple for both was not a good idea a posteriori, only use what is left of the waveform. So as I told you, the last cycles of the waveform depend on directly on the masses and spin of the final objects. If GR is correct, everything is all right, there should be an overlap, and it should also overlap with the full IMR, spiral measuring down waveform, and they do. You can quantify how this, what this tells us about GR being right, and this is done in this plot where we are showing the fractional offset in mass and final spin that you get using the in spiral only or the full waveform. If GR is correct, you should get the same value. You should get this arrow at zero, which you cannot see probably. And this is the 90% confidence level contour that we see instead from this plot. And basically, you see that it's compatible with zero. So this tells us that measuring mass and spin using only pieces of the waveform gives a result which is compatible with.
Question. So I mean, a different way of doing this would be just if you just look at your residuals and ask what is the reduced chi square.
We have done that.
And what is the reduced chi-square?
It's, okay, we didn't use chi-square, we used something different, but it's totally compatible with being instrumental noise. Okay. It's on the paper.
Right.
I had to pick a few things, so it's there, we can discuss this. The next thing, which I love personally, that you can do, it's checking the phasing evolution of the waveform, using actually only the spiral. And let me start with an introduction. The double pulsar that I mentioned has already been used in this paper by Nico Younes and Scott Hughes to put upper bounds to how much each of the post-Newtonian terms. For those of you who don't know, the waveform phase can be expanded in post-Newtonian. You can think of this as a power series in V over C. Okay, so 0 PN means lowest order, you know, and then V over C increases. Okay, the power of V over C. So you can check how much each of these terms can be different from its GR value, which would be zero, because this is the fractional deviation from GR of each of the post-Newtonian terms. In this plot, the triangle are the upper bound of this potential deviation from GR coming from the double pulsar, 0 PN, 0.5. And after 1.5, we have to put arrows because they are 15 order of magnitude above. Okay. It's not a totally fair comparison, but yeah. The squares are the results from the event we detected. I can go into technical details later if people want, but the way it works is literally what I said. You take each of these post-Newtonian parameters, and you tell him you are free if you want to deviate from GR, and you see how far it can go. At the 90% confidence level, this is the result, okay? So there is one term, the 0 PN, the lowest order, in which the double pulsar those better. And this is not surprisingly surprising because that depends on how long you can observe the system. They have observed for years. We had 0.2 seconds. Okay. But beside that, we do better by typically one order of magnitude up to 10 or 15. And again, I should point out that this only uses information from the spiral, since it's the post-Newtonian. And the spiral phase of this signal was very short. So in the future, as we get, hopefully, more low mass system, the spiral will be longer, and this can get even better.
So to understand, does 0 PM mean the Newtonian term?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So have you guys thought of doing something similar with the breakdown phase? As it were, the black hole could break down different from what you would expect in the
Earth? This is partially built in this part. I know that Satya, you know Satya is probably looking into that. As I told, well, I didn't mention this to everyone, but things have been pretty stressful the last 3 months. We have to be to pick a few topics. Okay, and finally, about the test of GR, massive graviton. So you know, I guess better than me, that we don't have a consistent theory of massive gravity because it's hard to do. On the other hand, Clifford Will has, put a paper together a while ago where he showed that if you just modify the dispersion, you see, you get an extra phasing term in the gravitational wave phase that depends on the Compton wavelength of the graviton. So we can add that to our waveform and measure or put a bound to the Compton wavelength of the graviton. And this is what plot shows. In the x-axis, you have the Compton wavelength in kilometer. This is 10 to the 13, 10 to the 17. And this is a probability. So the black line is the probability distribution of the posterior lambda g from the event. And if you work at the 90% confidence level, we get a bound of 10 to the 13 kilometer for the Compton wavelength. So this is better than the solar system test, which is, okay, it's a static test, but still, it's a factor of 3 better. And amazing enough, I was rereading the paper of Will, which is 20 years old. He said we would do a factor of 3 better. Okay. If you work with the double pulsar, it's even better. They get 10 to the 10 roughly. We do 3 order of magnitude better. For completeness, I should mention that there are other tests to bound the massive graviton, but they are very model dependent, they rely on cluster of galaxies. So in particular, for example, in this paper, there is some skepticism about those results. Okay, going toward the end, we are here. We just finished these 3 months run. Let me show you these two plots very quickly. These are frequency on the x-axis for LIGO and Virgo. And this is the strain of the noise. It's how good our instrument is. The lower, the more sensitive. Okay. And the color are the evolution of our sensitivity, so getting better with time, that we expect in the next few years. Okay. This has been done by Lisa and MIT. The run we just concluded was this blue band. In reality, we ended up being in the lower side, so in the good side of the band. And what is happening, and same thing for Virgo, which should start observing in the next science run, 2016-17, for 6 months. We hope to start somewhere this summer. Now, what will happen with respect to the run we just concluded is that LIGO will be more sensitive. We expect a range for, this is for neutron star, of 120 megaparsec roughly. But the big difference is that Virgo will be online. And I haven't basically touched at all sky localization, even though it's one of the things I work on. Having a third detector helps a lot in pointing telescopes, okay? So this is happening very, very soon, hopefully June or July or somewhere like that. And so to conclude, well, it's not really a conclusion. It's what I hope I can tell you we have done if we meet again in 5 years. Hopefully, no, the way things look so far, hopefully in 5 years, we'll have detected a bunch of binary black holes, and those will have helped us estimating or understanding, really, the distribution of masses and spins of black holes, and maybe something about their formation channels and progenitors. We'll be able to do better, I think, tests of GR than what we have done with this event, due to the fact that it was very short. And maybe get, for sure get a precise idea of, a better idea of the rate of formation of binary black hole in the universe. If we are very lucky, since in a bunch of LIGO, we'll see at cosmological distances, we may also get an idea of how the rates depend on the redshift. We are waiting for neutron star. I mean, all my talk has been about black holes, but until 2 months ago, these were the things we were expecting to detect, okay? So hopefully this will happen very soon. And these are just a few of the things we can do with binary neutron star. If we have a joint detection with electromagnetic counterparts, this will teach us a lot about the environment, again, the progenitor, maybe the GRB opening angle, and stuff like this. Something which I like, and I worked on it, learn something about the equation of state of nuclear matter in neutron stars with gravitational waves, since this can be pretty challenging in the electromagnetic band. And maybe, which is related, actually get an idea of the maximum mass of neutron star. And you can also do some cosmology, even though it would probably not be great at the beginning. And finally, even though we all love CBC, as I said at the beginning, there is a vast amount of potential sources for which we don't really know the waveform very well, but they are there, and it would be very nice to detect them. And I'll stop here. I'm done.
Any further questions?
Well, that was very long. I'm sorry, that was very long. I just realized.
Salvo, in the commission of the first phase of the detector, you showed that the evolution of the expected noise curve. The things went slightly better than upper area expected.
Yeah.
Is there a reason to believe that is the next upgrade more challenging?
Okay, so when these plots came out, that was a while ago, I asked someone who worked with the instrument at MIT, how realistic that is. And the answer I got is, how realistic these bands are. He told me the noise can be anything between zero and infinity. Okay, that's how committal they are. I honestly don't know. I know that during the first science run, there have been, especially in Livingstone, some sources of noise which are not been, well, not understood, because they're understood, but put under control. And the problem is that they are mostly in below under the Earth, which is where most of the SNR for this black hole will come through, because they merge pretty early. So I think, I'm not sure. We start from a very good initial sensitivity. And now telling you if we're going to be at the bottom or at the beginning of the green band, I don't know, honestly. I think people will put a lot of time and effort to fix, especially the low frequency part, because we now know that for sure, given the rate we calculated, we will have a few of these in these 6 months. And we want to get as much information as possible. Then these people are amazing, so I may be surprised, and they may be actually. What I think people will also put a lot of effort is not just doing this better in terms of how far away, but being sure that the two interferometers work for a long time simultaneously. Because for CBCs, it's okay, we know the signal, if it's there, even if you have a single interferometer, okay, you probably won't publish on PRL, but you can still believe that there is something. If we get something from a supernova or something unmodeled, you really want several interferometers to cross-check, okay? So increasing the duty cycle, this is what is called an interferometer, it's one of the key goals for the future. In O1, we shot for 50%. And as you can see from the fact that we have 16 coincident days, it was lower than that.
Regarding the phase constraints at the different TPN levels that we had towards the end, if I understood it correctly in your paper, then you did it in a way where you set all of them to zero and only allow one of them to vary, and then you did that for all of them.
Yeah.
So the first question is, does that include full analysis of all the other parameters? So did you allow all the masses and spins?
Yeah. All the GR parameters are free.
Okay. And then the second question, what would the plot look like if you constrain all of these parameters simultaneously?
Constrain on, you mean the GR parameters? So assume you know the masses, and you want to check for this? That's your question?
If you treat all of these parameters as free parameters.
Oh, the other way around. Okay, that's what I meant. It will look much worse. It will still be better than the double pulsar, because we have 15 order of magnitude of advantage. But there is a plot, another plot on the paper where this is shown. So what you're basically what he's asking is that instead of assuming that only the 1PN, for example, is not GR, and then the 1.5, what if I assume that all of them can be non-GR at the same time? The answer is that all the uncertainties get much worse because there is correlation between these parameters. We have done this in the paper. It is not in this plot because we wanted an apple-to-apple comparison with the paper of Younes, where they also assume that one by one vary independently. Okay. But it's in the paper. Coffee?
Okay, so Salvo's going to be here to the end of today. And then this is a quick reminder that we will have a colloquium on March 30th by Chad Hannan, which will continue the story. But let's thank Salvo.
Thank you.